This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Linda Mottram. This week, the world was transfixed as an immense container vessel jammed one of the world's most important shipping corridors. But it's a minnow compared to the ships of the future.
Just think about the size of the Ever Given. I mean, it's as long as two city blocks in Melbourne. The next generation of ships that's being predicted is likely to be even bigger.
And police officers are almost never convicted of murder in America. But could that change with the trial of the man accused of killing George Floyd?
If there was ever a trial where a policeman should be found guilty of killing an innocent civilian, this would be the case.
But first,
Australia's health and economic response to the COVID-19 pandemic is well known, and it is world leading. Australia is having a good experience with coronavirus compared to other parts of the world.
Leading the world out of the global pandemic and the global recession it caused.
For most of the pandemic, Australia has been out in front. But now it's come to vaccinating the population, things aren't going quite so well. 4 million Australians were supposed to have been inoculated by the end of March, but we've fallen well short of that, by about 3.4 million. And this week, as Brisbane went back into lockdown, it was the slow vaccine rollout that was blamed.
The question everyone wants answered tonight, why weren't the infected doctor and nurse vaccinated if they were treating COVID patients?
Never mind the COVID test, this fails the pub test. The nurse caught the virus while unvaccinated.
The outbreak had begun with two different healthcare workers who caught COVID-19 in the same hospital when they should have already been vaccinated. So how worried should we be about the vaccine rollout and what's causing the problems?
Australia has fallen way behind. Presently in international rankings, we're somewhere about number 90, sandwiched between Guyana and Albania.
Bill Botell is a health policy consultant and a former advisor to Paul Keating.
Now, the United States is vaccinating every day about 3.2 million people. In the United Kingdom, 40-50% of the population has been vaccinated. Australia has fallen behind, and it has fallen way behind because of political decisions made even 6 months ago. The one thing they did right in the United Kingdom at the end of last year was that they backed every horse in the race. Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, Novavax. And that meant that they had a very large supply on hand. Now, we decided to go with AstraZeneca, with effectively one supplier and some Pfizer, and the supply has not been delivered. The Prime Minister said there would be 4 million doses administered by the end of March, and it's just under 600,000, 10% of that.
How much of an obstacle has the supply chain been? You know, Italy blocking the export of 250,000 doses, for example. I mean, pretty hard to foresee that sort of thing.
Well, there are always ructions, but the whole world faces these problems. There's nothing particularly better or worse about the problems that face Australia, but we restricted the amount of vaccines that we could have available in early 2021 by the decisions we made. And I guess the idea was that there would be much more vaccine coming through from CSL and with AstraZeneca. Well, that hasn't come to pass. Okay, so what do we do about it? We have got to increase the supply of vaccines. We cannot drag this out month after month after month. We are in a race. And people who say we are not in a race have not really been paying attention. We're in a race against the emergence of variants, much more transmissible and deadly variants. We have got to 0-0 in Australia, and we have a window of opportunity to lock that 0-0 in if we vaccinate the entire Australian population.
So do we have enough vaccines here right now to ramp up the pace at this time?
Well, we do. We know that 1.7 million of those doses are sitting on warehouse shelves at the moment, unadministered. Now, a vaccine that sits on a shelf is no good to anybody. So there are clearly problems with supply, and there are clearly problems with distribution.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, the logistical challenges. What are they in a nutshell? Can you take us through them?
So the failure is that where doctors have put in new fridges for AstraZeneca and for Pfizer, which has to be stored at a colder temperature, they're geared up for thousands of vaccines to be distributed a week. But what they're getting is 50 vials and 100 vials or maybe no vials of vaccines delivered. So the people who are making appointments to be vaccinated are being told at the last minute these vials aren't there and so on. We cannot take our time with this. The idea that we are not in a race is just not borne out by the facts. It is no use just waiting and watching and seeing what happens to see how the virus changes and mutates. The sooner we're all vaccinated, the happier, healthier, and better off we will all be.
Bill Botell, he's a health policy consultant. He's at the University of New South Wales. Well, this week, all of those frustrations erupted very publicly as federal and state ministers blamed each other for the failures.
We're going to help the states, but they've got to admit they've got a problem because they've done three-fifths of bugger all. And they are holding this nation back.
Every time the Morrison government wants to deflect from their failings, they launch an attack on the states and territories.
So let me make it very clear. I'm as angry as I have ever been in this 15 months of war against this virus.
So who is at fault here and how do we fix it?
So to be fair, Linda, it's the largest logistic exercise that Australia has ever gone through. Getting two doses of vaccines into 20 or so million people is a big task.
Stephen Duckett is a health economist at the think tank the Grattan Institute.
But on the other hand, the Prime Minister announced the vaccine program back in August of last year, and so we've had plenty of time to prepare. Back in December of last year, Two logistics companies were contracted to actually get the vaccines from the warehouses to the GPs and so on. And so really we should have got it right by now, but it's been a logistics nightmare.
We've seen this federal-state blame game erupt this week quite unseemly. But is it those logistics companies that are doing a poor job here, or is some level of government responsible?
I think the Commonwealth government saw this as an entirely a good news story that was going to have a perfect rollout. We're all going to be happy. We're going to go to an early election with everybody vaccinated in September or October. Unfortunately, as the vaccination program has turned pear-shaped, the fingers started to point everywhere except me. And so you've ended up with this Commonwealth state blame game. The states are quite rightly saying, look, if you don't tell us until the night before how many vaccines we're going to have tomorrow, we cannot do any planning. We cannot actually make sure they go to the right places. And then you actually deflect the problems of the vaccine rollout onto us in the hope that we'll just grin and bear it.
So the Commonwealth sends the vaccines onto the states and the states then distribute them to the GPs.
So unlike all the rest of the health response to the pandemic, the vaccination program is led by the Commonwealth. They negotiated the vaccination deals. They're the ones responsible for the distribution. They allocate some vaccines to the states. And so the Pfizer vaccine basically went to the states, and the states were told, vaccinate your quarantine workers, vaccinate your healthcare workers. And they did that not necessarily as well as they ought, but they're doing it, and they've actually distributed a very large proportion of the vaccines they received. The Commonwealth then said, we will arrange with these logistic companies to actually get the vaccines to the GPs. So the Commonwealth goes straight to the GPs and the Commonwealth goes to the states who get it to the hospitals.
So in your view, is it clear who's right and who's fouled up here?
The whole program has had a number of bungles associated with it. But basically, there hasn't been a sense of urgency. Basically, the wrong model was adopted from the start, with sole reliance on GPs for getting the population vaccinated, when we really should have engaged the states and had mass vaccination centres as well. In a sense, if you think about it, a GP rollout strategy, it's a good thing to do. That is, it's a good thing to allow GPs to vaccinate their patients. GPs ought to provide a comprehensive primary care service. But a boutique strategy relying on general practice clinics, which are essentially small, they have small waiting rooms. You can't actually line up a whole lot of people to be vaccinated. You can't actually sit down a whole lot of people to be observed. It's a boutique strategy which will not deliver the numbers we need to be delivered. And so you've got to actually do a mass vaccination strategy as well, not as an alternative, as well.
So we should be lining up those sports stadiums and cathedrals right now.
We should be out now, and we should be saying, look, CSL is producing about 1 million a week. We need to make sure there's 1 million places a week where people can get vaccines into their arm. Let's step back and make an honest appraisal, and let's start again, because it really is important for us to get this vaccine rollout right and get it done quickly.
Stephen Duckett, thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda.
When a bystander filmed a white police officer pressing his knee into the neck of black man George Floyd in the US city of Minneapolis last May, the footage went viral. Now, the next few seconds is the audio of that recording, which, just to alert you, is not easy listening. It may be distressing.
What do you want?
I can't breathe. Please, the knee in my neck. I can't breathe shit.
Get in the car.
I can't move.
I've been waiting the whole time. Get in the car.
George Floyd's death during his arrest ignited massive weeks-long protests in the US and across the world, including here in Australia. This week, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the police officer accused of killing George Floyd, began in Minnesota. It's the focal point of a nationwide reckoning on race.
If there was ever a trial where a policeman should be found guilty of killing an innocent civilian, this would be the case.
Michelle Jacobs is a professor of law at the University of Florida, and she's a civil rights expert.
People are looking at this case to see, have we reached a point in time where a white police officer will actually be convicted for killing a black man. There's all kinds of ifs and buts as to whether that will happen, but surely people are looking to see, have we made some progress on this issue with the government's inability to convict white policemen for killing black people?
It is the case that we don't often see police in the dock, though, isn't it? How common is it for officers in the US to be charged with murder, let alone convicted?
So it's not common at all, because at the first level, we've got to get somebody to charge them, right? And that almost never happens. If you charge them, you've got to get a grand jury to indict them, and that almost never happens. And then if they get an indictment, you've got to the prosecutor has to actually win that at trial. And that's extremely rare to actually get that guilty verdict at trial.
So what is Derek Chauvin charged with? It's not just one charge, is it?
Right. So he's got three charges now. He's got the second degree unintentional murder and the second degree manslaughter. And then he has a third degree manslaughter, which was re-added recently. The defense lawyer for Derek Chauvin didn't want that, because that third degree charge is what we often refer to as the compromise charge, meaning that the jury may not be willing to convict on the higher charge, the second degree, but they also don't want it to walk away without anything. And so rather than find the person not guilty, they will compromise and render the third degree.
And Derek Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to all of those
charges,
but it's a sort of a menu of options in descending order. Would that be a fair characterization?
That would be fair. That would be fair, because we're looking at the intensity of the mental state, if you will. So by the time you go down to the third degree, you're looking at a case where you don't have an intentional killing, and you might be talking about something that was done recklessly. So it's less culpable in terms of the mental state, and of course the sentencing would be lighter.
So what are prosecutors arguing here? Because everybody's seen the video, of course, very dramatic, and a lot of extraordinarily harrowing evidence from witnesses this week. But what's the core legal argument from the prosecution?
So the core legal argument is going to be that Derek Chauvin intentionally kept his knee on George Floyd's neck, cutting off his blood supply, and failed to take notice of the fact that Floyd was in distress.
Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd, that he put his knees upon his neck and his back grinding and crushing him until the very breath, no, ladies and gentlemen, until the very life were squeezed out of him.
They're not charging him with an intentional first-degree murder. They're charging him with a murder that occurred because he didn't pay due attention. We also have a level of recklessness in the U.S. that is akin to murder. It's not intentional killing, but the level of recklessness is pretty high. So it's viewed as a murder. The manslaughter is also a lesser version of the intent, again. So even though he didn't intend to kill George Floyd, if that's the prosecution's argument, the behavior he engaged in was serious enough that it caused the death of George Floyd, and therefore he has culpability for that.
Now, we're yet to hear the full defence case, of course, but we've heard something of what the defence will be arguing. What is their case?
So, of course, it's the dog whistle defence, which I like to call it, which all police officers use when they kill someone. And that is that the person who was murdered is responsible for their own death because they didn't submit. Because they were either having some kind of psychiatric episode or whatever, and the police had to subdue them in order to care for them, and in subduing them, they killed them, right? So this is exactly what the defense lawyer opened on.
The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd and the officers began to struggle. You will see that three Minneapolis police officers could not overcome the strength of Mr. Floyd.
He said that it took three officers to subdue George Floyd. That is why he died. It didn't have anything to do with Chauvin trying to kill him or engaging in conduct that was inappropriate. And then their fallback argument is that Floyd died because he had high blood pressure, he had heart disease, and the adrenaline he was experiencing combined with the heart disease and the high blood pressure, and that's why he died, in addition to taking the fentanyl.
The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia that occurred as a result of hypertension, his coronary disease, the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and the adrenaline flowing through his body, all of which acted to further compromise an already compromised heart.
Now, of course, there's a problem with that argument, because if the adrenaline was produced from Derek Chauvin trying to kill him, then that we have a causality factor there. And so even under normal circumstances, that would be a causal link between Derek Chauvin's behavior and George Floyd's death, which would make him guilty of at least a manslaughter.
And is the defence capable of arguing that Derek Chauvin was following police procedures in terms of use of force?
So he's going to argue that, but I think it's going to be difficult for him to establish that, because one of the unusual things about Minneapolis Police Department, which kind of shows you that additional training doesn't help the police refrain from killing people, is that the Minneapolis Police Department already had not only implicit bias training, but they had de-escalation training, and they have a mandatory intervention policy for all police officers. If you see a police officer who is with you engaging in inappropriate use of force, all of the police officers who are accompanying have an affirmative obligation to intervene and to stop the unlawful amount of force. And I think the testimony from the EMT really is on point with that.
So based on your training and experience and what you had seen, what did you want to do for this person on the ground?
I would have checked his airway. I would have been worried about a spinal cord injury because he had so much weight on his neck. And I would have checked for a pulse.
Because, you know, here's this firefighter who comes up to the police, identifies herself as a firefighter and an EMT, and says, look, this guy is in distress. He needs medical attention. And they refused to allow her to give medical attention.
And were you able to do that, any of those steps?
No, sir.
Why weren't you able to do any of that?
Because the officers didn't let me in to the scene.
It's going to be hard to say that he followed procedure on that.
Well, it's got a way to run, so I apologise for asking you to pull out the crystal ball, but how likely do you think is a conviction in this case with all these charges that have been brought?
You know what? I would love to say that there's a good likelihood of conviction. If not in this case, what case can you get a conviction? But the history of it is the dog whistle about the big brutish black man who is terrorizing two or three police officers who are all lethally armed does work in most cases where the police are on trial. And that's going to be the reaction that has been the reaction when the dog whistle is blown. And this is exactly what the defense lawyers for police officers know, and it's what they use to get their clients acquitted.
Michelle Jacobs, it's always a delight to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Linda.
For much of the last week, the world was transfixed by a tiny excavator and a team of tugboats trying to relaunch a huge cargo ship that was blocking the Suez Canal. The ship is called the Ever Given. Its plight launched 1,000 memes, but the economic impact is no laughing matter. A skyscraper-sized plug jammed into one of the world's most important shipping corridors was costing, by one estimate, $13 billion in stalled trade for every day the Ever Given was grounded. More than 350 other ships were forced to wait in line. But that could just be the start. David Fickling is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. His specialties are commodities, transport, energy and trade.
It's not often that the whole world is actually obsessed with container shipping. Mostly we forget that it actually exists.
Indeed we do. So can you bring us up to speed a tiny bit? Let's start with this ship, the Ever Given itself. Like, how does something like that get stuck in one of the world's most important trade routes?
Well, they're still trying to work that out as far as we can see. One theory that a writer for the Financial Times argued is that it's just actually so big that it's a bit like a pump moving through a channel. It changes the sort of flow of the water going through there because it's just so big, and that can cause it to be kind of sucked towards the bank. There's clearly been influence of some very high winds that they've had there. And I think the essential point, though, is that these ships are just getting so massive that any small deviation from the path is going to cause a problem like this. So it is, it's a fact of how things are growing.
So tell us, how big is the Ever Given? Like, is it the biggest in the world compared to other ships? And indeed, how big is it compared to what people are envisaging for ships of the future?
Yeah, well, go back to the dawn of container shipping, and there was a size class of ships that was called Panamax. This was the biggest ships that could go through the Panama Canal. And they could carry 5,000 shipping containers. Around about the late 90s, they start getting bigger. A maritime professor does a prediction in 1999 that they're going to hit a hard limit of about 18,000 containers, and you just physically can't get bigger than that. The Ever Given is 20,000 containers. Now, there's about 100 either sailing or under construction that are 20,000 containers or bigger. And the biggest of them are even bigger. They're 24,000 containers. They're 20% bigger than the Ever Given. Just think about the size of the Ever Given. I mean, it's as long as two city blocks in Melbourne. It's pretty much as long as Martin Place in Sydney. It's absolutely enormous. The next generation of ships that's being predicted is likely to be even bigger. There are arguments about whether we can get any bigger than this, but there's certainly predictions that within this decade we will see 30,000 containers on a ship. That's 50% bigger than the Ever Given. McKinsey, the consultancy, reckons that within about 50 years we're going to see 50,000 containers. That's 2.5 Ever Givens.
Oh my gosh.
So the size just keeps on going up.
Okay, so what issues are we likely to face as these larger ships become more common? I mean, are we going to see these ships getting stuck more often, for example?
It's obviously a very real possibility. This is one of the things that this has raised. And it's worth bearing in mind just how how much we're sort of pushing up against hard limits. These ships are 400 meters long. The longest ship ever was about 450 meters long, which is a big oil tanker that built in the 70s. That size is really defined by the problems of sort of waves and tides and the stresses they'll put on a ship hull. You can't get much longer than that. Also, the quays at ports are not much longer than that. And in terms of depth, the Ever Given fully laden goes 16.5 meters under the water. You need about 3.5 meters clearance to take account of sort of waves and tides. So you need 20 meters for it to pass fully laden. And a lot of ports are only 20 meters deep. If it goes into the port of Rotterdam, you need to go in at high tide to be able to get through the channel. Then consider the Suez Canal itself is 24 meters deep. We've extended the Suez Canal in the past. You've dug it deeper and dredged it deeper. But at this point, 24 meters, that's pretty much the depth of the Strait of Singapore and Malacca. That's a whole other issue. You know, is it even possible to dredge major ocean straits like that any deeper than they already are? It's not clear that that is possible. So we may be really finally hitting the absolute size limits.
Do you think, I mean, with your crystal ball in front of you, and we won't hold you to this, do you think we've hit the limits?
Part of me thinks that we have, but every time people have predicted that we would hit the limits, we find new ways of increasing size and new necessities to increase size. If I was to say my most radical notion, and this is real sort of pie in the sky stuff, it would be that we would eventually, by the mid-century, we would see these very large 50,000 container shipping vessels. And they would not be controlled by private companies. They would be controlled by governments because the power plant that they would need to have a nuclear power plant, which is, of course, what you have on the biggest aircraft carriers in the world. And there's no way that we're going to have nuclear-powered shipping of that size just for proliferation risk that's in private hands. It needs to be well defended. And there's not many ports that such a ship could go to. That would be the sort of radical science fiction vision of where things are going. The other alternative is that we peak where we are now at about 25,000 containers and we can never really get beyond that. Maybe we have finally hit the limits.
David Fickling, very interesting times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's Saturday AM for this week. We're on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.